Let us all sing together Master's favorite poem, God, God, God. The wording that I use is the wording that he had. It's a little different now in the books, but this one time a few years ago, I woke up and heard this melody with the song and wrote it out. From the depths of slumber as I ascend the spiral stairways of wakefulness, I will whisper, God, God, God. Thou art the food, and when I break my fast of nightly separation from thee, I will taste thee and mentally say, God, God, God. No matter where I go, the spotlight of my mind will ever keep turning on thee. And in the battle din of activity, my silent war cry will be, God, God, God. When boisterous storms of trials shriek, and when worries howl at me, I will drown their noises, loudly chanting, God, God, God. When my mind weaves dreams with threads of memories, on that magic cloth will I emboss, God, God, God. Every night in time of deepest sleep, when my peace dreams and calls, joy, joy, my joy comes singing evermore, God, God, God. In waking, eating, working, dreaming, sleeping, serving, meditating, chanting, divinely loving, my soul will constantly hum, unheard by any, God, God, God. More and more, it's becoming an easy thing, at least to recognize what the directions in life ought to be. Granted, there is increasingly in the world an emphasis on meaninglessness, a conviction that life has no goal. But at the same time, more and more people are knowing it's as if light and darkness both were increasing apace. More and more people are becoming aware that there is such a thing as an altered state of consciousness, that there is such a thing as meditation and communion with higher realities, and communion, at least that there are people who believe in communion with God. More and more people have heard words like karma and reincarnation and guru and yoga and life after death, which is becoming a very sort of popular subject these days. More and more people know these things, but back when I was in college, and some of you were in college at the same time, there was a complete, at least as far as I knew, there was no knowledge of these things at all. When I made up my mind that I wanted to find what life was all about, the most that I hoped to gain when I thought of going and spending my whole life meditating and seeking God, the most I hoped to gain was peace of mind. I thought even that's worth it. But I had no idea of the wonderful opportunities, the wonderful promise that exists on the spiritual path. And we were talking at the table a few minutes ago about what a wonderful thing it is here at Ananda, where we can give children the teachings that are right for people, teachings of non-attachment, teachings of not living for desire, but for duty and for truth, teachings of living for noble ideals and so on. It isn't that we were born without these things. We wouldn't be on the path now if we hadn't had that kind of spiritual karma, because it takes that kind of karma to recognize truth when you find it. What was painful in those days was knowing that these things were so, and yet finding this chorus of voices all around us from people who were laughing at the whole idea and saying, oh, they're ridiculous. Of course you should have desires. When I was in college, I had an interview. I transferred from Haverford College to Brown University. And I had an interview, as everybody had to do, with the college psychiatrist. And we actually had a very pleasant talk, and he was enjoying my company. And we had a mutual friend, and it was a nice sort of friendly, relaxed discussion. And he obviously seemed to like me and like the way I was handling life. And then he asked me a question to show you the level of ignorance in this world. This is a man who's supposed to be helping people. He said, do you like books? And I said, yes. He knew I was wanting to be a writer and so on. And he said, do you have many? Well, I had about 300 books, all Greek classics, Roman classics, Shakespeare, and very nice assortment of all really good books. And so he said, well, I'd like to ask you a question. How would you feel if some morning you woke up and you'd found that somebody had stolen all of them? I said, I'd feel fine. Why should I care about losing something like that? And he said, that's the first thing you've said that's disappointed me. Can you imagine? But that's the kind of teaching you get in this world. It's all scrambled. You get a few good things and mixed with it is all kinds of absolute nonsense. Look out for number one is the sort of message that you're given. And anybody, I talked to a wealthy woman one time and I was saying to her that, I said, I can't imagine somebody just keeping all that money and living just to please themselves, building a nice home and getting yachts and so on, when there's so many good things to do. This was a relative of mine, and she said, you know, that's a novel thought. Just imagine. People just don't have any conception of right values in this country, where they think only of exhausting what little karma, what little good karma they get, where they only think in terms of the here and now, the moment, but not in a spiritual here and now, not the eternal now, the ephemeral now, where they only think in terms of getting for yourself, where they only think in terms of taking at the expense of other people for oneself, where attachment is considered a virtue, where desires are considered the necessity for any kind of ability to advance, where the thought of living for God, even in the churches today, there is the thought that expressed by many theologians, don't think about God, he's somewhere off there, think about man. Well, how can you think about man properly if you don't know the spiritual reality of man, which means the God within man, which means thinking of God first? Again and again and again, people found themselves, in a way that's much less so today, subjected to a teaching that made them feel that maybe I'm crazy. Maybe there's something wrong with me for wanting these things and for not wanting their things. Maybe I've just got to try to live their way of life, and yet knowing that their way of life would make them absolutely miserable. But in those days there was no alternative. If your good karma was telling you that this is what you ought to do, everybody else was telling you it's what you ought not to do. And so you began to think, can I alone be right and all of them be wrong? That didn't seem very humble, and anybody who wants to be truthful is bound to want to be humble, not just to hammer on his own opinions. So it is that today things are very different that way. Yes, people go through some of the same problems. Obviously, many, many young people have told me that when they read about these episodes in the book, that in the path, that they identified with them very much. They'd gone through something like it. Nonetheless, I never heard the word karma or yoga or guru or all these other things. They just didn't exist for me. I didn't know what it was all about. I didn't know you could commune with God. I didn't know that it was possible to do anything about meditation. I didn't know you could be a vegetarian. It's a very different age now in these respects, that at least you get an idea, you get an inkling that these things are possible. And as soon as your karma is a little bit that way, you begin to be led that way. It'll be much more so when we have built these communities and gotten our younger generation trained into right habits from the start, so that they know without having to go, once you've discovered what's right, you've got to work out all those bad habits. And they won't have that. At least I hope they don't. I hope that we can go the direction we've gone so far, which looks like we're going to be having some wonderful, wonderful children with ideals and understanding and knowing what life's really all about, so they don't have to go through so much ignorance, and they can really serve as beacon lights for other people. And that's why, particularly, I'm so really keen on spreading our community school system all around the country. Not for the sake of getting lots of people into Ananda schools, but because it will change the world if you can really bring the young people up. Master was very keen on that, but he discovered that he first had to get the adults into it, because without the adults being in it, they wouldn't send their children to it. Now it's happening more and more. But back in 1948, when I met Master, it was really a complete eye-opener to me that such goodness could exist in this world. Not just Master, but all the people I was suddenly surrounded with. I didn't realize that there were spiritual people in America. I didn't realize that there were people who really wanted to live for God. All the people I'd ever met wanted to become millionaires. I mean, it seemed that way. It's not literally true. But suddenly I found that there is this whole strata of America that has this yearning also. And Master was probably the greatest single influence in the modern world, as far as I am aware. I could be mistaken, but particularly here in the West and particularly in America, I think of him as the greatest influence for bringing people these deeper teachings, not from just a philosophical standpoint, but from a standpoint of experience, from a standpoint of really growing in love and joy and consciousness. Master, well, now already he has something of the aura of remoteness. And it's easier to see, looking back in time, how great he was. Living with him, it's always a different experience when you live with somebody. I mean, he cleans his teeth, and he burps after a meal, and he tells jokes, and he's a human being, as well as this great consciousness. But when you're right with him all the time, and the conversations of philosophy get mixed up with conversations of ditches that have to be dug, and all these daily things, then it's a little harder to actually see. I myself, have to say, perhaps it was almost, I wish it had been less so, but I was always, in a sense, in awe. I always felt as if I'm in the presence of God himself. It was such a powerful vibration that he put out. But then I think, well, I came to him when he was toward the end of his mission. I was only with him the last 3.5 years. And I wonder what it would have been like back when he was a young man. I do know that of the thousands and hundreds of thousands of people who met him, they weren't capable of really appreciating what they had at that time. And I don't know that I could appreciate as well what I had then as I've been able to as I've grown on the path. I've often wished, oh, if only I could have known as much as I know now, have grown as much as I have grown now, which God knows is perhaps not very much. But it's a lot more than I was then. And if only I could have come to him then with that much, I'd have gotten so much more. But then I suppose I'm sure I'd have been making the same complaint 30 years from now about my present state. And so the experience of being with him, in a way, it's something that we can appreciate much more standing back. He was so engaging. He was so humorous. He was so full of joy. He was so human. He could talk in a natural way with everybody. I was very often responsible for serving him when he had guests. And all these different guests would come, and he would just reflect in a natural way he would talk with them. It isn't as if he'd reflect their personalities, but he'd reflect their essential person. Each person's unique, and he would reflect that uniqueness back to that person in a way that that person was completely natural, as if, well, here is a good friend. They may have only just met, and yet there was that ease about him that made them feel that this was the best friend perhaps they'd ever met. So it's difficult, in a way, to see the totality of greatness when you see the sweetness there. Sweetness, of course, is a much greater kind of greatness than many that we would call great. But sweetness and humility and so on are wonderful qualities. But to see him, first of all, in the broader context, looking back, I can see even more now, although I felt it then. I have to say that I did. But in context, it's more clear in the context of a broader picture of history. And you see that what he brought to America was not as if in meeting an individual he reflected the essential person of that individual. It was also in coming to this country he reflected back to America the essence of what America can and ought to become. In other words, America has many options before it. It can go down the drain of materialism. It can get involved in electronics and gadgetry and finally blow itself up with a bomb if it isn't careful. It can go toward pleasure. It can go toward power politics. It can go toward money. It can go in many different directions. But there is also something about America that makes it unique among countries today. European countries, and generally speaking all over the world, people talk of the materialism of America, and God knows America is materialistic. But it's also in many ways a very, very spiritual country. It was founded on spiritual principles. People came to this country for religious freedom. And you find, for example, in South America, this was pointed out to me by somebody from South America, that the people who came to South America were looking for gold. And he said, since then they've continued to have nothing but revolutions and problems. But he said, people came to this country originally looking for God. And he said, something that he felt in coming up here from South America and living in this country, and Master spoke of it too, something here has a very, very spiritual karma. It's not only in America, in the white people coming here, it's also in the soil of America. There has been a great civilization in ancient times. The American Indians have taken some of that greatness, and some of their philosophy is very deep and very close to the highest philosophies in the world. And so it's a combination of circumstances. This basically spiritual karma of this continent, a kind of natural spirituality, a spirituality in tune with nature, and then the people coming here for that purpose. Now, mind you, when I say that, I'm not really speaking as a person, as an American, for example. I've never strongly felt that I was an American. I've always felt more either European, partly English, and very much Indian. And of those four, Europe, England, India, and America, I'd say that America came forth in my own natural thing. I've had to develop this kind of attunement. So I'm not talking out of blindness or bigotry, but talking rather from the opposite standpoint, that I had the feeling that America was very materialistic, and it's taken me a long time to learn how very deep the roots of spirituality are. And traveling around the country and the world and seeing the contrast and realizing that after all we're not living in a golden spiritual age, it's not Satya Yuga. It is a materialistic age, but granting that, among all this materialism, there is also a very wonderful quality here, which is why Master and other great saints have come to this country. But thinking of it in that way, we find, and you all epitomize this, just to backtrack for a moment, when I was in India in 1960, and I had to go back to America for a visit, and the thought came to me of how painful to go back to all that, the freeways and the smog and the restlessness, and to go away from this wonderful ashram scene where people are just always chanting the name of God and they only talk about God, and it just hurt me so deeply to have to go back there and leave what I knew was my own real country. This is where I've lived so many incarnations, is in India. And God sent me, I suppose, I could put it this way, an American at that time who just reconciled my heart to all the wonderful devotees back there. She was so childlike and simple and sweet and just full of enthusiasm for truth and God. And it just made me remember all those wonderful souls back there in Los Angeles, in the church there in Hollywood and at Mount Washington, and that I'd met around the country. And it made me just completely reconciled to coming back here. Well, this is what I see in all of you. This same sweetness and childlike quality, this openness to truth. Being a young country, there is less of the tendency to judge and weigh in the balance and just say that I want to know. That kind of readiness that comes from not knowing very much sometimes, that enables a person to just charge ahead and expect to get somewhere quickly, where Indians, for example, know that it takes a long time, and so it takes them a much longer time than it does here when people don't know that it takes a long time. Master said, eventually, why not now? That's the American spirit that I like. Now, this is what I found in Master, that he was an American saint. He was an Indian, yes, and he never lost that Indianism. But at the same time, he reflected to America, not just to individuals in America, but to America, what America could be, and the vision that he held for it in the future, if Americans will only live up to that vision. Granted, he always held up to us an ideal that was perfection, an ideal that not everybody was able to live up to. It's up to us to make it possible for Americans to live up to that. It isn't necessarily true that it will live up to it. It is surely true that many Americans will, but it's really up to us to try to help people in this country. And that's again why I feel that this is not an age for people to withdraw into hermitages and be cut off. I have seen a few examples of that around. People who have gone into a situation where they're only thinking about their own inner progress. Some people have gained from it, yes, but generally speaking, I haven't found it happening, because the vibrations of this country at this time seem to demand more of an outward service, more of an outward spiritual involvement, not involvement in other people's delusions. And in that, Master wanted to draw the best out of us that he saw. That's what he was giving to us in his life. He was much more human than most avatars, but just think, what would he have been, what kind of image would he have held up for the generality of Americans if he had been always just sort of absolutely aloof from everybody, not talking to anybody? He came down to their level and lifted them from that level. What would it have been like if he hadn't had a sense of humor? I know a lot of saints in India who are great saints, but who don't laugh. Could he have gotten by in America without laughing? Could he have gotten by without a lot of patience for the nonsense that he had to put up with from people? It's a whole different scene, and if you've taught in India and lived there, you'll have some idea of what I'm talking about, that actually it's so wonderful to be in a country, I'm talking of India now, where you don't have to talk just basic philosophy to get people to move anywhere, because they don't know very much yet, where you can assume certain shared knowledge and then go on from there. And it's possible to go so much more deeply into devotional topics, and it's wonderful to teach in India, and it's wonderful to be in the ashram scene there. And much as I enjoy being with real devotees here, as I love being among all of you, going out into the world and teaching and reaching people on their level is not nearly as spiritually satisfying as it is just to share spiritually. But at the same time, this is what is needed today. This is what God wants of us today. This is what God has in mind for this planet. And He has it in mind for this planet, for America to be one of the shining lights, spiritually as well as materially, in the future. So Master came here to reach us on a level that we would be able to understand. He didn't talk as some teachers do there in a very abstract way. He always talked in a very human way. He tried to bring his teachings down to a natural level where people would feel not that I'm in the presence of an avatar, but that I'm in the presence of a wonderful person, a wonderful human being. He was so very kind and gracious in all ways. You'd think that, well, a person on that level is not, he's sort of above playing these games, but he was so much better at all that. It wasn't games, but he could appreciate where people were coming from and relate to them in their way, but always in such a gracious way that it somehow changed them, it charmed them. I remember, for instance, a group of children coming and singing Christmas carols at Mount Washington just 2 or 3 days before Christmas. And Master listened to them, and then he insisted on giving them some money. And they didn't want the money because they felt joy in singing for him. And he said, but you must give me joy too, and this way I can have joy in serving you. And this sweet humility was so touching to them that they couldn't refuse. That kind of consciousness that I saw him able to relate to all kinds of different people in their way, and just accept that they were who they were, not holding up impossible ideas for them, but always sort of inspiring them to some kind of higher and higher ideal. The respect that I found in Master for all people was something that I really was not prepared to meet. I assumed that people who are great, well, you know that saying they have in Boston, isn't it something like the Cabots talk only to the lodges and the lodges talk only to God, or is it vice versa? Anyway, somebody's only talking to God because he's so high up there. And here we found somebody who was so great that he could talk with God face to face. And yet, he was so respectful of all people. He just accepted them as they were, and he saw his own divine heavenly Father there. I saw this again and again, that sweet story that I told in the path about Andy Anderson, who was a very sweet person himself, but he tended to get drunk. He was the foreman on the job at Hollywood Church, and he was not a disciple, although he ended up becoming a disciple. But he'd come to work with his beer, and that would be his lunch, and sometimes he'd come to work staggering. And Master knew who he was, but he saw his good heart, and that's all Master looked at. He didn't see people's faults. He only saw their goodness. He only saw their potential. And so, Andy, Master wanted him to pour a driveway at Mount Washington. And Andy said that it would need to be only a couple of inches thick. And Master said, well, we have big trucks coming up to the print shop carrying paper, and we ought to have it thicker. So what do you think with those trucks? And Andy said, well, all right, 4 inches is enough, sir. And Master said, with a very sweet smile. I couldn't understand why that sweet smile when they were talking about pouring concrete. And Master said, make it 6. And Andy was about to protest, and he saw this sweet smile, and he said, all right, sir. And Master had seen what would happen, and that's why he said that figure. The day that Andy came to work to pour the concrete, he arrived just drunk, staggering drunk. And he was trying to hose the cement down and didn't know what he was doing. And he was just much too much water. The cement was getting warped and it would have become too diluted. And it was because it was 6 inches thick that it became strong enough. If it had been 4 inches thick, then it would have broken, it would have cracked, it would have not worked. But Master's sweet smile was because he could see what was going to happen, and rather than say, you come to work sober, he had so much respect for Andy that he thought, all right, he has his own freedom, and I've trusted him to do this job, so I'll take the penalty. I'll just pay for that extra 2 inches of concrete, and take the penalty myself so it's done right, but let him just follow his way. And that kind of respect, that kind of giving everybody his freedom and going an extra distance himself, inconveniencing himself, as it happened in this case, for the sake of another person's rights and freedom, this is the essence of the attitude with which he taught even those who were close to him. I never saw him impose his will on anybody. It was always, if we wished it, he could be stern, but only to those who wanted it from him. I remember one monk there who was sort of a weak person, and therefore Master didn't ever scold him. And one day Master introduced him, and he said, this is Andy, I call him my baby. And he said, I call him that because I'm babying him. And then he said to Andy, you don't mind my saying that, do you? Oh, no, sir. He was at that time just trying to test the waters there and see if Andy was ready for a little more. And I think he decided he wasn't. And so he kept it there. But he would sometimes test it to see, are you ready for a little bit more? And the answer he got from Andy showed him it wasn't time yet to discipline him more. But he would only discipline you if you wanted it. And he wouldn't do it until you wanted it. And he'd always sort of test you to see, well, could you take it yet? Did you want it? Then if you didn't want it, he'd always just hold his tongue. And if you protested, he just would stop any kind of disciplining that he'd give you. But if you really put yourself in his hands, then you knew that you had a friend. And you knew that it was a wonderful thing to have a friend who was willing to help you to overcome your faults. Because your other friends would only flatter you, would only try to see your good points, and so on. But Master always tried to help us to achieve what we ourselves were looking for, which was freedom. None of us wants to be in this ego. We know that we're unhappy, bound in this body and bound in this personality. It's the source of all our worries, all our troubles, all our suffering. It's the source of everything that we don't want. We don't want it, but we cling to it. How much greater that friend is who can help us to get out of what we are, and rather than that one who keeps us in it. Those who had that kind of wisdom, and they weren't many. It isn't easy being around a master. Listen, you're around somebody who knows every thought that's going through your mind? Huh? Is that all that easy? Not always. Not always. You're around somebody who's challenging you. If you want that from him, you're around somebody who is giving you the very thing that you don't want. Okay, I came to Master over-intellectual, right? I wanted to get out of my over-intellectuality. But he, in his effort to help me get out of my over-intellectuality, one time he was talking about something, and with a sneer of utter contempt, he said something about this intellectuality like this. And I thought, gosh, he knows I'm trying. Why does he have to have contempt for me? But what he was doing was trying to get me to have contempt for it myself, so that I'd get out of it. He'd play games like that that were serious games because he was trying to get you out of it. But you're always willing to take the lesson if you understand it. But what about if you don't understand it? It's a lot harder. But he wouldn't try to help us to understand it because then we wouldn't grow. We're so used to these counseling sessions. You've got a counselor in high school and you get called into his office and he sits you down and he says, now listen, Martha, I just want you to understand this. Now, if you have any questions, ask me. But he goes on like this for God knows how long, and maybe you understand and maybe you don't, but at least you get the impression that he's tried. Well, with Master, you got the impression that he had no intention of trying. he did have the intention of trying, but his way was different. He would put it to you in a way as almost to confound your reason, in order that you'd bring to bear a higher kind of understanding. He didn't explain himself. His teaching was much wiser than that of an ordinary counselor, but he would give it to you in a way always that made you have to think it through yourself. This wasn't all that easy for people to take. He would often talk in a way that seemed illogical, because he was trying to take you out of your logic. He said, "I don't want your reason. I want you to listen to truth, and truth often is above reason." But we're so used to reason in this country. We're so used to things making sense in a way that we can see A plus B equals C. And there was no asking him, "Well, sir, would you explain it?" He'd give you another explanation that was worse than the first. Just sort of toss it off like that. But I found that it was an absolutely marvelous education. Because what he was giving us was experience. What he was giving us was attitudes. What he was giving us was tools to work with, not the answers. So yes, sometimes he'd give us answers. I don't mean that he always left us in the dark on things. Sometimes it was necessary to explain. But so often it would be that he was trying to give us those tools to work with that we could work on our own. Now, how many teachers are like that? Most teachers want following. Most teachers want somebody under their thumb. Most teachers are not ready to put you on your own feet, because that means that they are not in the picture enough. They want you dependent upon them. But Master was not like that at all. He always wanted us to stand on our feet. You know, Dayamata tells the story about how she was, when she was very close to him for years, but when she was around him, he wouldn't speak to them. He would say, if they wanted to talk, he'd say, "The silence is the altar of spirit. Be quiet." And he wouldn't allow people to talk to him around him at all. And then guests would come, and they would sit down and have long talks with him, and he would be sharing so many wonderful spiritual truths and so on, and they would say, "Oh, how wonderful it must be for all of you who are around him and getting this all the time." And they just smiled and said nothing. But, you know, it was by osmosis. When we came into Master's presence with a lot of questions, somehow in his presence we wouldn't have those questions anymore. The real answer to our questions is not an answer on that level, an intellectual answer. The real answer is that state of consciousness where you don't feel like asking because you understand. When you reach that level, and this is what I'd find with Master. I'd come to him with a long list of notes of questions I wanted to ask, or all sorts of things in my mind I wanted to ask. And then with him, I'd feel peaceful, and I'd go away and I'd realize I hadn't asked them. But I wouldn't kick myself for not having asked them. I'd know I didn't need to ask them. It didn't seem necessary, because by osmosis, he was changing our consciousness so that we understood. This is the essence of spiritual growth. And what he was trying to give us was to understand from within, not intellectual answers, but to understand from within, the right attitudes, the right insights. When you get this, I know I said to him one time, he was talking to us about meditation and saying that he was urging us to meditate a lot. And this was when he was more in seclusion. Well, he was also talking about the disciples who had been close to him for many years, and how busy they had been working. I know Dayamata would be going to work when Sister Ganamata was getting up. She'd say good night, and Sister Ganamata would say good morning. But he had them working night and day. And I said, "Well, when did they get to meditate?" And he said they didn't need to meditate as much, because in the closeness to this body, they got that advancement all the same. That magnetism changed them. And he said, "You all have to meditate more because you're not as close to this body. We all have to meditate more because that body is no longer in this world, although it inspires our inner thoughts and our inner consciousness. He's as much with us as ever, but it takes more work to get to him. When you were in his physical presence, you didn't have to work. It happened." So we've got to try to attune ourselves with that inner reality. But the way that he taught was the way he's actually wanting to teach us right now, too. From within, to feed us those inspirations that will help us to understand Again and again over the years since he left his body, I have felt his guidance. I have felt answers to questions. I have known what it was that I had to do, or what I needed to say to somebody to help them, just by my asking him. Suddenly the answer was there, and until I asked him, it wasn't there. Putting two and two together, I figure that it was he who's done it. The quality of a master in the last analysis is not his personality. This is what he puts on in order to inspire us, in order to teach us, in order to know what we could become. But ultimately, he is that indwelling Lord in our own hearts. And he hasn't any reality but that. Sometimes people define Master in terms of his personality, like saying, oh, Master liked this. My idea of it is that he liked everything, and showed it by his liking this, that, and all other things. He didn't have a personality, really. It was something he told me that when I seem that I'm ready to incarnate in a new body and see the personality I'm to assume, it feels sort of like putting on a hot overcoat on a hot day, sort of itchy and uncomfortable, and then I get used to it and accept it. But he wasn't that personality. It was just as you have to live through a body if you've got a body. So if you've got even a saintly body, you've got to work through not only the body but the brain, the personality. Certain, you've got to have that, but you know in that state that it isn't you. Well, what was the illustration that Master gave to us of the ideal life? A life of non-attachment. We read stories about his humor, we read stories about his very human quality of just his humility and respect and genuine love for everybody. He was so natural with people. But there was another side too. He was very much withdrawn from everything. Nothing really was real to him. He didn't see it the way we see it. He saw it in completely other, with completely different eyes. When I met Sri Rama Yogi, this great yogi that I've mentioned here this week, I said to him, perhaps I was being a bit cheeky in saying so, but I'm glad I asked him. I said, you've got so much to give people. Why don't you give to more people? He had one or two disciples around him, just a small handful. And he, as I told you this week, he said, God has done what he wants to do with this body. Then I said to him about Master, that he had said that he would, as long as there is one stray brother crying by the wayside, he would ply his boat back to these shores again and again, a trillion times if need be. I told him this, and Sri Rama Yogi said, but you must understand, when he said I, he wasn't talking the way you would talk. He wasn't thinking of himself as a person. He wasn't thinking of himself as a personality. The divine would send that particular little spark of itself out into this world. But this is a thing that very few people, even who lived with Master, could understand. That he wasn't really there at all. There was nobody home. You'd see him laughing about something, and you'd look into his eyes, and you'd see this absolute calmness and dispassion. You'd see him enjoying something, you'd look into his eyes, and there was just not a blank look at all, just a very distant, sort of omnipresent look, as if this was such a small thing in his consciousness that he could hardly notice it. That stillness in his eyes, you looked into his eyes and you'd see they just didn't move. They were just always steady, always still, deep. My feeling about Master was always on this level, that it was really, this personality that he expressed was beautiful, and it was an inspiration, and it was a guide. But I always felt that behind all of that, there was just this infinite consciousness that was just trying to keep one little body going. That was the reminder that he always put forth to us who lived with him. When he was mixing with people in the world, he would be more on their level, and not talking of God unless they wanted to talk of God. He could mix happily and easily with anybody. He could talk with truck drivers, with drunks, with politicians, with ambassadors, with housewives, with movie stars, with doctors, with scientists, with laborers. He was just everybody's man. He could just reflect back to them what they were with complete naturalness. But living with him, and he trying to teach us the attitudes of the devotee, we who were there to really learn as much as we possibly could, rather than be inspired to at least get our feet wet on the spiritual path, which is what most people in the world would have been that he met. To us, he talked in a very, very much more withdrawn way, in the sense of, don't be involved. Don't be concerned about things. Be responsible, yes, but don't be attached. Everything that he said was geared toward, like when I said something about my father, instantly he said, you have no father. And he said it strongly. Some people who read his book and hear about his sweetness and compassion are really not prepared for the strength of his personality when they hear it on tape. But that was the strength that he really put out. Love itself is strength. You can't love truly and deeply without being very, very strong. The strength of divine love is cosmic. It's the strength that creates universes. And worldly people can't stand up to that. Master, in a way, would put a veil over that side of his nature when he was talking with people in the world. And much of his own book was that veil. Much of his book just showed this joy and this sweetness and this love, but it didn't give as clear an idea of that tremendous power of consciousness behind his life. Living with him, we got more of that sense. We got this sense of the complete lack of compromise with the world. He wasn't interested in phenomena, in miracles, in possessions, in gain, in fame, in anything except that one thought: to identify ourselves with God. He was rather more severe than we were, many of us, able to appreciate or live up to. He was holding up an ideal that he hoped that over the years we would gradually grow into. He was aware that we would have to come at it, each one in our own way, but even in little ways. I remember Bernard and I were playing a game of chess, which I did practically never, but it was an interesting thing, and somebody brought a chess board to Mount Washington, so we had a sort of chess tournament. And Master called either me or Bernard, I forget which of us, and they said that, he said, where are they? And they said that we were playing chess, and he very impatiently said, what a waste of time, like that. But this was the attitude that he had toward the things of this world. And it's an attitude that many people who aren't yet devotees couldn't have lived around. In fact, many who were devotees couldn't take. And I suppose in the last years of his life, he was getting much more rigid, and strict with us, because he knew that he would soon be leaving this body, and that he wanted to have a band of followers who would really want to teach his teachings properly. But I know that there were a lot of people who couldn't handle the sternness with which he viewed the importance of seeking God first. With humor and with love and with compassion and with all wonderful qualities, but in the last analysis, it does come down to a life or death matter. If we go toward God, we find life. If we go away from him, we find death, even in life, in the midst of life. Because there is only one life in this world, and that's the life of the Spirit, the life within. The more we have of that life, the more this world too takes on beauty. But the less we have of that life, the more we live in the midst of death. Jesus Christ put it this way, I came that you might have life, and have it more abundantly. He wasn't speaking of existence. You can't have existence more abundantly. You either exist or you don't. But he put it also clearly when he said, let the dead bury their dead. That means that most people who are walking around, it's just a question of time before the undertaker finds out that they're dead. They've been dead for years. You look at the eyes of most people in the cities as you walk through the streets. There's no enthusiasm there. There's no life there. There's no joy there. It's a sad, empty husk of a life. Master saw the spiritual path as literally a choice between life and death. If we seek God, we have life eternal. And if we run away from Him, we can't run away forever. There's nowhere to run. But we won't have anything but conscious death while living in this world. Let us make that choice here. His example is, to my mind, the ideal one for this century, for this country, for this particular era in history even, though he lived before it. His practicalness. So many saints in India tend to be sort of daft, in not daft in the sense of foolish, but daft in their complete uninterest in the things of this world. Like Sri Yukteswar, he was far from daft, he was so wise, but not involved in the world. Master wanted him to replace a deerskin of his, which was a rug of his that was getting threadbare. And Sri Yukteswar said, "That's your world." Meaning not you're attached to that world, but I've sent you to deal with that world. I don't have to, ha ha ha. But he was saying, "This is my world right here. Just this little asana in my bed. I don't need more." Master's cousin told me when they visited Sri Yukteswar's ashram in Puri that the building was in such a state of disrepair, the rafters were sort of teetering. He said literally before we walked through the room upstairs, we would hold our breath and charge through, praying that it wouldn't fall while we charged through. Sri Yukteswar just didn't care. He couldn't have cared less about anything in this world. He was just always within himself. But he had sent Master to deal with this world. It was Master's job. Maybe in past lives Sri Yukteswar had done it. I don't know. But that kind of practicalness was Master's role. And he was trying to show us that we must be practical, but that we must spiritualize our practicality. He enjoyed practical people. He liked the people around him to have common sense. And in that I'm reminded of something that Teresa of Avila used to say. She said that the primary quality that she wanted in her nuns before they were accepted into the convent was that they have common sense. She said if they don't have devotion, they can get that. But if they don't have common sense, they'll never get that. Well, Master was a man of great common sense. He wanted us to see this world and deal with its realities and deal with every reality on its own level. So, pardon me, he would try to put us in situations where we would learn how to deal with the world. I know that he was very careful in teaching me how to speak to people, because he wanted me to reach them on a level that they would understand, not to be satisfied that I had put out something that I understood. And sometimes I would say something to somebody in a long way from Mount Washington, something that had no way of getting back to Master. And Master would just casually scold me for having said the wrong thing to that person. How could he know? I was so surprised one time when I had been at a B'nai B'rith celebration, or is it a celebration? Whatever it was. It was a function of some kind. And some atheistical doctor there in Beverly Hills was challenging me on spiritual things, and I thought to answer his challenge by talking about a few miracles that Master had performed. Well, you don't talk to Beverly Hills atheistic Jewish doctors about miracles. It's it's just not the way to reach them. And Master told me that I should not have talked about such things to people who were not ready for them. And I was surprised when he showed that he knew this. And his answer was very, very calmly and matter-of-factly, but very deeply. He said, "I know every thought you think." Well, that's a bit scary. But I must say I was grateful for it. It was so wonderful to know that there was somebody in this world who knew me as I was and liked me. I mean, I knew all these faults myself, but for somebody else to know it and still like me, my, that was wonderful. It was so reassuring to know that I had this kind of friend. He was on our side. He was there to help us if he could. He was not ever there to judge us. He was not there to tell us how bad we were but he was always there to encourage us to become better. So this kind of practical nature, again, is so much a part of his teachings and his mission. Again, a part of that practicality is the blending of the inner and the outer life, the spiritual life, blending it with the outer life, so that we learn to work in the world and yet also have this life with God. You know, many times I've wished that Divine Mother would get me off the hook and just give me the money I need to build Ananda. I've wished it, but she hasn't done it. And I have two choices before me. One is that she's absent-minded or disinterested or that sort of thing. And the other is that maybe it's what she wants. I sort of prefer to go with the second choice. It seems to me that here we are, we're not hermits. We're really trying to, if most of the people living here, if they weren't here, they wouldn't be in a monastery. They'd have jobs in IBM or Sears Roebuck or God knows what other horrible worldly kind of pastimes they'd have to be involved in. And Divine Mother is not trying to say, look, here's an alternative that'll help you to drop out of society. Divine Mother is trying to show a viable alternative so people can continue to support their families, continue to work and earn their living and send their children to school and all those things, and yet do it in the name of God and do it with spiritual people so that you feel that you're serving God and that you're surrounded by others who are of like mind. And I feel, and I have found, that whenever we put out the energy, Divine Mother supplemented that energy, but she didn't give us all the energy, we had to do it too. Well, this to me is essentially what Master is trying to teach us in the West. I know that Tara, when she first met Master in 1924, had the opinion that he was only in this country to gather a few disciples, take them back to the Himalayas, find a cave, and spend their whole lives meditating. And he told us when he got Mount Washington, it was the start of his world mission, really, to get that headquarters there. And her only comment was, now your troubles begin. She didn't see his world mission. She didn't see the need to balance. She herself was really a hermit. But his purpose was to bring us to that state where we could continue to live lives of self-support, lives of practical relationship to the world, not to drop out of society, but to live it in a practical, real, constructive, serviceful way, and at the same time do it for God and in the consciousness of God, to blend the inner and the outer life. That's what his life was all about. He didn't dress like this when he walked around normally. He went to church and gave lectures and services and satsangs in his robes. But otherwise he dressed in a business suit because he didn't want to Indianize America. He wanted to spiritualize America in its own context. He wanted to make America, to bring out the best of what America already had and not to impose some kind of foreign culture on America. Well, these are all things that we want to learn from him. And this is why it really helps to study the episodes of his life on a personal level, to see that kind of the qualities that he manifested, the divine virtues that he manifested. They give us an understanding of how to be that way ourselves. And on a general level, the way he lived his life, the way he lived in the world but not of it, he was completely non-attached all the time. Nothing really fazed him. Nothing bothered him. One lovely thing is to, I guess none of you will ever get this opportunity, I suppose, it's too bad, but to see all the old scrapbooks from the days when he was lecturing around the country. And there were a lot of people in those days who didn't know anything about what he was or who he was, who tried to make all kinds of write all kinds of absurd articles about this Hindu yogi, and after all, yogi and yo-yo and yogurt all were sort of the same word. And they just tried to make fun of it many times. Many articles about him were sort of written tongue-in-cheek, and Sometimes you'd find some very self-righteous minister writing against him and so on, and then you'd see the picture of Master, and he was always so innocent and so open and so good that you just help, you couldn't help feeling that there's nothing these people can say that can bring him down one inch. As he used to say, praise cannot make me better, blame cannot make me worse. I am what I am before my conscience and God. And that's how he always lived. He was always so full of this sweetness and love that he was obviously, it was like water rolling off a duck's back. One time in India this happened, that the English, they were afraid that he was there to foment trouble, and they always had detectives sort of prowling after him to see what he was going to say. And they paid some English woman, young woman, in Mysore at the palace of the Maharaja to come up and fling her arms around him and kiss him. And just then the photographers would take pictures, and this would be blazoned all over the in the newspapers on the front cover. And just to make a fool of him, make him look silly. And Master, of course, being a master, knew what was going on. And as soon as she approached and she started to, she took a step toward him and her hands were out like this, he picked her up like this and he said, all right, take your picture. And this triumphant smile on his face, it just... he always won out. He just his personality was such, so charming and so victorious that you couldn't beat him. Even if the whole thing had gone through as planned, it couldn't have beaten him, because he was so completely in himself. He was so completely centered in himself. He was so completely a master of himself that he was a master of every occasion, every circumstance that could possibly come up. Well, what is it ultimately to talk about a master and to study the life of a master? It isn't to say about what a wonderful person he was. I kind of, many times people ask me to talk about him and I feel a bit in a quandary. You know, it's strange. I've probably got a larger collection of stories about him than anybody else has in the world. And yet, I made it a great point to go around gathering all these stories from the disciples and writing down these things and so on, and he told me to do that. But people ask me to talk about him, and I feel it's difficult, because all those stories to me illustrate principles. He's not a personality. His life was to illustrate a truth that we can live and that we should live. What he was, we should try to become. And everything that he accomplished, we should use as our guideline to try to accomplish that ourselves. And though we fail 1,000 times, we should just get up and try again. None of us is perfect. Nobody should condemn or judge another person, not even himself. But try always, just try again, to become better. We're here in a very serious thing. We're here to lift ourselves out of death, out of the jaws of death, which we're living in all the time until we have God consciousness. We're here to live for God. And his life set us a guideline, which if we follow and take seriously, and not say what a wonderful thing that he was that way, but rather take those principles, take that example, and think about these things that we can live in our own lives, we'll find that his life was really something that was intended for you and you and you and me. His life was intended to show us a way, something that we could do to grow and to reach that perfection. As he said to us often, what I have achieved, you must achieve. There isn't anything that I've achieved that you cannot achieve. His only purpose was to make him on the same level as himself, one with God. So I find it often difficult to talk about him as a person or as a personality, because he wasn't that. I like to use stories of him to illustrate principles. Otherwise we get into these sectarian differences of saying, oh, this one's greater than that one. He wasn't like that. He never made that kind of comparisons. He said, God is playing through us in this way. Let us be grateful for that. He plays through others in other ways. Let us be grateful for that also. Let us live then in the thought that everything that he did was for a purpose, not to show us who he was, but what we can become. Let us meditate on the episodes of his life as they're contained in his book, in my book. I have a lot of stories that I can still tell, probably as many as are in the path right now, and someday I'll put them into a book too. But meditate on those episodes in order to understand not who he was, but who we really are, underneath all these sands of delusion, who our real self is, because each one of us are what he was, sparks of God. We're here to find God. We're here to live in his joy.